Well, good evening and welcome. I'm Simon Roberts, a longtime colleague of Professor Michael Zander's in the law department at this school. And I'm here to introduce Michael for the third of the current series of Hamelin lectures, which he's giving under the general title of The State of Justice. You've already heard two of them. It's obviously an enormous honor for the school and the department to provide the venue for this series. Michael was, of course, a member of the department until his retirement last year, and he continues to teach a pretty full schedule of lectures for us, something which we're jolly grateful for, Michael. He joins two other very distinguished former members of the department, Glanville Williams and Otto Kahn-Freund, as a Hamelin lecturer. I shan't say anything about Miss Hamelin or her will, apart from expressing appreciation that she has made this occasion possible. Others have talked about the woman herself and the will before earlier lectures. It just remains for me to introduce Michael Zander's lecture this evening under the title Criminal Justice. He knows a lot about this subject. He was a member of the Runciman Royal Commission on Criminal Justice at the beginning of this decade, and he did a large-scale Crown Court study for the Commission. We all await his lecture this evening with very great interest. Michael.
Well, can I thank Professor Simon Roberts for that friendly and cordial greeting and introduction. In my first lecture on the state of justice, I spoke of justice and access to justice. Second lecture was on civil justice, and today, as Professor Roberts has said, the topic is criminal justice. Criminal justice encompasses a vast, ramshackle system, if system is the word, involving a great variety of institutions and professions. They include the police, the Crown Prosecution Service, barristers and solicitors in private practice, courts, judges and magistrates, the probation service, the prisons, and a variety of other penal establishments. Public expenditure on criminal justice currently runs at some £12 billion a year. Not that all this does much to deal with the problem of crime. According to official Home Office figures for crimes against individuals and their property, of 100 offences committed, 45 get reported to the police, 24 are recorded by the police, 5 are cleared up by the police, and just 2 result in a conviction. So the criminal courts touch only the fringes of the problem of crime. Perhaps this is less surprising when one considers that there's no basis for a sentencer to believe that he or she knows what sentence will work in terms of reducing recidivism. Statistics show that a depressingly high proportion of defendants are reconvicted within a couple of years or so of completing their sentence, regardless of the sentence. Custodial penalty or non-custodial penalty, statistically it seems to make little difference. Some offenders cease offending, or at least they're not reconvicted, which is not quite the same thing. But a court that passes sentence has no sound basis for predicting how the sentence that it imposes will affect the individual defendant. However, the problem of how to make an impact on the problem of crime is not my subject. I'm concerned here rather with how the system functions after a suspect has been apprehended, up to the final disposition of an appeal and post-appeal remedies. This was broadly the range of topics addressed by the Runciman Royal Commission on Criminal Justice, which reported in 1993. The Royal Commission was set up in 1991 at a moment of widespread concern about the system after a series of spectacular miscarriage of justice cases. There may therefore have been an expectation that the Commission would come forward with radical proposals for reform. But that did not happen. The Commission unanimously concluded that the system was basically sound, and that what was needed was not radical change, but rather a general tuning up of most of the existing working parts of the system. Given the sense of crisis at the time of the setting up of the Commission, it was very striking how little call there was for significant change. In the 900 or so memoranda of evidence submitted to the Commission, there were, for instance, virtually none that urged the adoption of the continental so-called inquisitorial approach, under which the judges, rather than the parties, play the dominant role, both pre-trial and at trial. Virtually no one proposed changes in the familiar basic institutions: the police, with responsibility for laying charges; the Crown Prosecution Service, responsible for deciding whether the case goes forward, and if so, on what charges; summary trial by benches of three lay magistrates, supplemented in some urban courts by a small number of professional stipendiaries who sit alone; and trial of more serious cases in the Crown Court by judge and jury. There seemed equally to be general agreement that, despite a great deal of controversy at the time of its enactment, the 1984 Police and Criminal Evidence Act, PACE, had settled in well, and 5 years later merely needed some relatively minor adjustments. Where virtually no one is urging radical reform, it would be remarkable if a royal commission, with its balanced composition almost by definition a vehicle designed for compromise and moderation, were to recommend any dramatic changes. So it was hardly surprising that the Runciman Commission accepted these basic features of the existing system as given. In my first lecture, I suggested that evaluation of the working parts of the criminal justice system requires consideration, in respect of each topic, of the appropriate balance between the interests of the prosecution, the interests of the defense, and the interests of due economy and efficiency. Obviously, in a single lecture on the criminal justice system, I cannot cover all the relevant topics. I start with an issue that was not addressed by the Runciman Royal Commission: the question of the difference between justice in the Crown Court and justice in the Magistrates' Court. Everyone would agree that they are different. Most would agree that the Crown Court is the superior model, which is why it deals with the most serious cases. But it does not follow that there is anything wrong with justice in the Magistrates' Court, which deals with well over 90% of all cases. The James Committee in 1975 said that the widespread belief that trial by jury was superior to trial by magistrates seemed to be based on two main grounds. One was that a randomly selected jury brought a more impartial mind to bear on the issues than can magistrates, who, quote, inevitably become case-hardened and may be too ready to accept the prosecution case. The second, James said, was that jury trial was presided over by a professional judge, that both sides were generally represented by specialists in advocacy, that the pace was slower, resulting in the issues being brought out more thoroughly than was possible in a busy magistrate's court with a crowded list. The James Committee said that there was very little information on which to compare the quality of justice dispensed by the two levels of courts. The committee rejected the view that the higher acquittal rate in the Crown Court proved anything. Quote, for it to be meaningful, it would be necessary to establish whether it was due to juries acquitting those who were in fact guilty, or magistrates' courts convicting the innocent. For all one knows, the difference in the acquittal rate may be the result of a very different approach to what is meant by the requirement of proof beyond reasonable doubt. A recent study on how ordinary citizens interpret the standard formula for the criminal standard of proof, you must be satisfied so that you feel sure, showed that nearly three-quarters of the sample thought that that meant you must be 100% sure. If that really is a widespread view, it would go a long way to explain the fact that juries have a higher acquittal rate. It might also suggest that the formula should be changed. The James Committee equally rejected the view that the very small number of appeals from the decisions of magistrates indicated general satisfaction with summary trial. Quote, "There are many reasons why a convicted person may choose or feel compelled not to exercise his right of appeal, although he genuinely believes that the conviction or sentence is unjust. The committee declined to express a view as to the quality of justice dispensed by the two levels of court." The Runciman Royal Commission recommended that proper research in the jury room should be permitted, but it seems now unlikely that that proposal will be implemented. The prospects of an empirical study being undertaken to compare decision-making by juries and by magistrates seems even more remote. The James Committee referred to various improvements in summary jurisdiction, especially in regard to training of magistrates and court staff, and in the expansion of legal aid, and said that continuing developments of that kind would, quote, "we hope go at least some way to removing what may appear to many defendants to be the unsatisfactory nature of summary trial." Developments of that kind have continued and are continuing. There have, for instance, been important recent changes in the system for training of magistrates. As from 1998, the training of lay magistrates includes such topics as reaching impartial decisions. For example, raising awareness of one's own conditioning and personal prejudices, labeling and stereotyping, language and cultural differences, and body language, and effective participation on the bench. For example, ensuring equality of treatment to all court users, ensuring that witnesses are not bullied, observing people and conduct, challenging discriminatory views. New magistrates are now assigned to experienced magistrates who are supposed to act as mentors. In 1998, the Lord Chancellor's Department, the LCD, issued a consultation paper regarding improving the qualification of court clerks. Also in 1998, the LCD issued a consultation paper on the selection of magistrates. It raised for consideration whether the long-standing attempt to achieve a political balance on the magistrate's bench should be scrapped in favor of a new system that would attempt to achieve a balanced and more representative bench on the basis of a broader range of geo-economic factors. However, it was announced in October 1999 that the Lord Chancellor had reluctantly decided to retain the political balance system for the time being, as the proposed new geo-demographic system had failed to win sufficient support. The announcement stated that officials in the LCD would be asked to try to develop a new approach looking at occupational categories together with such factors as age, sex, and regional spread. These are all indications of a concern regarding at least the appearance of justice. But knowing how to improve the quality of justice is much more difficult. Research suggests, for instance, that sentencing disparities as between different magistrates' courts are not explained by the social class composition of the magistrates' bench. If that is right, it follows that altering the social class composition of the bench, whatever it might do for the reputation of the system, will not iron out such disparities. The Lord Chancellor has recently caused upset in some quarters with the announcement that there is to be a research project to examine whether the current balance between the use of the 30,000 or so lay magistrates and the 100 or so full-time professional stipendiary magistrates is correct, whether each is deployed in the most effective way, and the weight of the argument for and against each. Some fear that this could be a signal that the lay magistracy is about to be consigned to the dust heap. I regard that as most unlikely. The terms of reference for the inquiry specifically state, quote, the government is committed to the principle of the lay magistracy continuing to play a significant part in our system of justice. Also, the government's overriding concern is to have in place a system of criminal justice in which the public have confidence. Even if it were to turn out that the stipendiaries are actually cheaper than lay magistrates because of their much greater throughput of cases, I hope that this categorical statement of government policy stands. The lay magistracy has its faults, but I would prefer most summary cases to be decided by three laypersons rather than by one professional, if only because three heads are better than one. In that context, it's relevant that research in London by an American scholar, Professor Shari Diamond, suggests that lay magistrates are slightly more lenient in sentencing than their professional colleagues. Professor Diamond concluded that the difference was not the result of naivety on the part of the lay magistrates. Quote, a primary source of the lay magistrates' greater leniency appears to be the voluntary part-time role the magistrates play in the London courts. For the professional magistrate who sees general crime control as a major responsibility, the offender is only one element in the sentencing decision. In contrast, the lay magistrate is less concerned with the general sentencing policy of the court and focuses more on the individual offender than on the community at large. For me, that is a powerful argument in favour of the lay magistracy. No matter what reforms and improvements are made in regard to magistrates' courts, it's obvious that the main differences between the two levels of criminal court will remain. They are systemic differences that flow from the essential nature of the two institutions. Since it seems to be accepted as a given by almost everyone, it is perhaps not sensible to treat it as a problem. What definitely is a problem is the method of allocating cases to the two levels of court, which has been and remains a subject of fierce controversy. Of all the 352 recommendations made by the Runciman Royal Commission, the one that provoked most controversy was that defendants should lose their right to insist on jury trial in what are called either-way cases, and that if prosecution and the defense could not agree, the mode of trial should be decided by the magistrates in the light of statutory criteria. The proposal was denounced by a wide variety of commentators for taking away a valuable, or rather an invaluable, right. 6 years on, the Home Secretary, Mr. Jack Straw, announced this May that he intended to implement the proposal, despite having strongly criticized it when he was in opposition. The bill to give effect to that intention was published last week, and it has its second reading, as it happens, today. The government estimate that some 12,000 cases currently dealt with in the Crown Court would, as a result, be handled instead in the Magistrates' Court, with a net saving in cost of some £105 million. The Runciman Commission was unanimous on the subject, and I can report that its members, though bloodied, were unbowed by the storm of criticism that the proposal provoked. I acknowledge that diminishing access to jury trial does have the wrong ring about it. But there are powerful reasons that support this change. One is that a majority of defendants who elect jury trial in either way cases later decide to plead guilty, often at the door of the Crown Court, when the case has been prepared and listed as a contested case. The result is the waste of time and effort of preparation of those cases, not only for lawyers and police officers, but also for victims and other lay witnesses. Understandably, many defendants who elect Crown Court trial do so because of the higher acquittal rate. In a Home Office 1992 study, this was the most frequently mentioned reason for choosing the Crown Court by both defendants and solicitors. In the view of the Royal Commission, the defendant should no more have the right to choose the court that gives him a better chance of an acquittal than to choose a lenient judge. Another important factor in the Commission's view was that the same research showed that when samples were matched, judges were three times more likely to impose immediate custody, and sentences were on average 2.5 times as long. Also, of course, cases dealt with in the Crown Court are hugely more expensive than those dealt with in the Magistrates' Court. All of these were important. But I think that for most members of the Royal Commission, the main reason was one of principle. That where prosecution and defence could not agree, it was for the system, rather than for the defendant, to determine where he should be tried. The 1997 Neri review of delay in the criminal justice system pushed this point of principle to its logical conclusion by recommending that the court should always determine the matter, and this view has prevailed in the government's bill. I see the force of that and do not object to it. The statute will require the court to take into account all relevant matters, including the effect of a conviction on the defendant's livelihood or reputation. In considering the potential effect on the defendant's reputation, the court can be told of any prior convictions, though magistrates who receive such information will not then be permitted to take part in a subsequent trial. In a gesture to the critics, there will be a right of appeal to the Crown Court against the decision that the trial be heard summarily. This will add to the cost and the delay, but I imagine the Home Office calculate that it will not be used by many defendants. One criticism made is that it will lead to two classes of justice, one for the defendant with prior convictions, the other for those who have no convictions. The Royal Commission's view was that the presence or absence of prior convictions is a legitimate issue when it comes to consideration of the appropriateness of jury trial as a means for protecting someone's reputation. A person with prior convictions, at least if they are for similar offences to the current charge, has less of a reputation, and to that extent, though only to that extent, has less of a claim for jury trial than someone who has no prior convictions. 9 out of 10 of those who elect jury trial after the magistrates have indicated that they're willing to hear the case summarily do in fact have previous convictions. There's also opposition to the proposal on the ground that it will impact especially on the ethnic minorities, because it is said they disproportionately distrust trial in the magistrates' courts. But in the absence of any evidence that magistrates are disproportionately likely to convict ethnic minority as compared to white defendants, I personally do not find the ethnic minority's alleged lack of confidence in the system sufficient reason for rejecting this reform. The empirical evidence to date shows that both in the Crown Court and in the Magistrates' Court, black defendants are actually more likely to be acquitted than white defendants. A great deal more will be heard of these arguments in the coming weeks. Whilst the row rages in England, it's worth noting that in Scotland, the defendant does not have a choice of court. The matter there is decided by the prosecutor, which seems to give rise to no problem whatsoever. It's safe to predict that jury trial will continue to be the mode of trial for contested cases in the Crown Court. The only doubt I see is over long fraud cases, a subject that's been under discussion now for some 30 years. One should, of course, do whatever can sensibly be done to improve the presentation of evidence for the jury in complex cases. It may also be that there are regulatory alternatives to criminal trials in some less serious cases, as tentatively recommended by the Runciman Commission. But if there is a criminal trial, I prefer that it be with an ordinary jury. I'm not aware of any evidence that an ordinary jury cannot cope. Moreover, I've yet to see an acceptable proposal as to what might replace it. In 1988, I opposed the abolition of the right of peremptory challenge without giving any reasons, of 3 potential jurors per defendant. The government alleged that the right was being abused by defense lawyers to eliminate from the jury anyone who looked educated. The evidence was entirely anecdotal, and a Home Office study showed that use of peremptory challenges had no measurable impact on the conviction rate. It seems to me that the peremptory challenge was an acceptable and indeed desirable safety valve, giving the defendant a feeling of participation in the selection of the particular peers who are to try him. But it's gone, and I see little prospect that it will be restored. Certain categories of persons are ineligible for jury service because of their involvement in the justice business, or disqualified by reason of their previous convictions, or exempt because they are deemed to have more important business elsewhere. Recent Home Office research, based on a sample of 50,000 persons summoned for jury duty, has shown for the first time how few of those summoned for jury service actually serve. 13% were ineligible, disqualified, or excused as of right. There's a strong case for drastically paring down these categories of exclusion so that more or less everyone is liable for jury duty, as is increasingly the case in America. No less than 38% of the sample were excused, typically on medical grounds or because of care of young children or elderly relatives, or because they said they couldn't afford time off work. 15% simply failed to attend, in half those cases because the summons had never reached them. That left 34%. Of those, half had their jury duty deferred, usually because of work or holiday commitments, and many later got a further deferral or were excused. Next year, the task of handling the selection and summoning of juries for the whole country is to be taken away from local courts and given to a new national clearinghouse in London. Maybe that will lead to some tightening of the system. The Home Office study may appear to support the widely held belief that jurors are not representative of the whole population. But the biggest study yet of the composition of the jury, carried out in 1993, suggested otherwise. Based on returns from a random national sample of over 7,500 jurors, it showed that the socio-economic composition of English juries was remarkably close to the makeup of the general population. The Runciman and Royal Commission was persuaded by the Commission for Racial Equality that in racially sensitive cases, the judge should have the power to authorize a special procedure to achieve that the jury contain up to 3 members of the ethnic minority community. The jury bailiff would be instructed to draw names randomly until 3 such people were drawn. Lord Taylor, the then Lord Chief Justice, opposed this recommendation. In a speech to the Leeds Race Issues Advisory Council, he said this: "Though put forward for the best of motives, this proposal seems to me the thin edge of a particularly insidious wedge. The jury is the foundation of our system. It's drawn at random from the law-abiding inhabitants of the locality in which a case is tried. We must on no account introduce measures which allow the state to start nibbling away at the principle of random selection of jurors. Jurors must not be seen," he said, "as representing the views of the community or of discrete parts of it, nor indeed of representing either the complainant or the victim. On reflection, I think that on this issue, Lord Taylor was right and the Royal Commission was wrong. I've always been a very strong supporter of the jury system as incomparably the best known way of dealing with serious cases. Sometimes, admittedly, the jury gives a truly perverse verdict, one not only contrary to the evidence and the law, but which is even inexplicable in terms of what is sometimes called jury equity. But such cases seem to be very rare. Research suggests that generally the jury's verdict is explicable in light of the evidence, and when it is not, it usually seems to represent the jury's reaction to what it considers to be an unjust law, an unfair prosecution, or the threat of an excessive penalty. The jury's capacity to do justice in defiance of the law, as in the case, for instance, of Clive Ponting, has been part of its historic role over the centuries, and we would be poorer without it. There is as yet no right of appeal by the prosecution against a jury acquittal, save in the very rare situation when it can be established that the acquittal was probably the result of intimidation or other form of jury nobbling, for which someone has been convicted. Recently, however, the Law Commission has proposed in the aftermath of the Stephen Lawrence case that in certain circumstances a second trial should be allowed. The offence would have to be punishable with 3 or more years of imprisonment. The new evidence would have to strengthen the prosecution's case sufficient to make it probable that a jury would convict, and the prosecution would have to show that the new evidence could not, with due diligence, have been obtained before the first trial. The decision would be for a High Court judge, subject to a right of appeal to the Court of Appeal. The court would have to be persuaded that a second trial was in the interests of justice. Despite all these safeguards and restrictions, I am unhappy about the proposal. If a High Court judge allowed a second trial on the basis that a conviction was probable, in what sense could the defendant get a fair second trial? I would mention at this point the story in the newspaper this morning informing us that the Attorney General, in a speech that he made yesterday, is proposing that the Law Commission should be asked to look at a separate, much broader issue, namely a right of appeal for the prosecution against a judge's adverse ruling in the case. For example, that the judge might rule evidence to be inadmissible, he might direct the jury to acquit, he might throw the case out for abuse of process, and in all those kinds of situations, the Attorney General, the Lord Chancellor, and the Home Secretary are saying, maybe the prosecution ought to have a right of appeal, perhaps subject to control in the sense that it would be for the Attorney General himself, or perhaps for the DPP, to authorize the appeal. That is obviously a very far-reaching proposal. One hasn't had time to study it or even think about it, but I just mention it as relevant in this context, and this is something that will obviously come forward in months or maybe in the next year or so as a proposal from the Law Commission. Roughly 1 in 4 of those convicted by a jury appeals against conviction. In the absence of any fresh evidence, the Court of Appeal is understandably reluctant to overturn the jury's decision. It hasn't seen the witnesses or heard the evidence. Mastering the transcript of a trial sufficiently well to reach the conclusion that the jury got it wrong is a formidable task, especially in a lengthy case. But occasionally, the Court of Appeal is prepared to make that judgment. In 1968, in the case of Cooper, the court went so far as to say that it would quash the conviction if it had a lurking doubt. Quote, "The court must in the end ask itself a subjective question, whether we are content to let the matter stand as it is, or whether there is not some lurking doubt in our minds which makes us wonder whether an injustice has been done. This is a reaction which may not be based strictly on the evidence as such. It's a reaction which can be produced by the general feel of the case as the court experiences it. It would be remarkable if the court actually applied that very liberal approach, and in practice, it didn't do so. In fact, one of the court's most experienced past members, Sir Frederick Lawton, told the Runciman Royal Commission that the reason the judges did not apply the lurking doubt test was that they didn't accept that it was a sound way of administering criminal justice. The Runciman Commission said that it understood the court's reluctance to quash the jury's verdict, but it urged that where, and I quote, "on reading the transcript and hearing argument, the Court of Appeal has a serious doubt about the verdict, it should exercise the power to quash. That would not undermine the system of jury trial." Previously, the court had the power to quash a verdict if it was, quote, "unsafe or unsatisfactory." The revised formula in the 1995 Criminal Appeal Act, Section 2, now provides for the verdict to be quashed if it's found to be unsafe. There's no doubt that the single word "unsafe" still allows the court to quash the verdict on the ground that the jury got it wrong. But is the court supposed to apply the lurking doubt test? In moving the second reading of the Criminal Appeal Bill, the Home Secretary said of Section 2 that it, quote, "in substance, it restates the existing practice of the Court of Appeal." During the parliamentary debates on the bill, Lord Taylor, the then Lord Chief Justice, assured the House of Lords that the word "unsafe" would not result in any narrowing of the grounds of appeal. But since the lurking doubt test was in bad odor with the judges and was honored in the breach more than in the observance, this assurance was perhaps not worth very much. Personally, I agree with Sir Fred Lawton that the lurking doubt test is too broad. In my view, the court should apply the test proposed by the Royal Commission. It should quash the conviction where it has serious doubts about the jury's decision. But the change from the old formula of unsafe and unsatisfactory to the new formula of unsafe raises a further fundamental issue. Does the new formula still permit the court to quash a conviction where it finds nothing wrong with the jury's verdict on the evidence, but where its concern is with the way the prosecution has conducted itself? The police fabricate a confession, or secure one, by beating up the suspect. But there's plenty of other perfectly sound evidence that the accused was guilty. In one sense, the conviction is safe. No doubt has been raised that the defendant committed the offence. On the other hand, the prosecution have behaved in a scandalous manner. Can the Court of Appeal quash the conviction on the grounds that it isn't safe? The majority of the Royal Commission took the line that if there is solid evidence of guilt, the conviction is safe regardless of whether the prosecution has behaved badly. So far, the judges have disagreed on this important issue of principle. There have been cases where it has said it could not intervene, and others where it said it could intervene. My own strong belief is that the Court of Appeal must be free to express its repugnance for especially objectionable conduct of the police or other prosecution agencies. It's not sufficient to say that the prosecution misconduct should be handled separately by disciplinary action against the police or others concerned, even if that occurred, which too often is not the case. I dissented from the view of my colleagues on the Royal Commission. Quote, "The more serious the case, the greater the need that the system upholds the values in the name of which it claims to act. If the behavior of the prosecution agencies has deprived a guilty verdict of its moral legitimacy, the Court of Appeal must have a residual power to quash the verdict, no matter how strong the evidence of guilt. The integrity of the criminal justice system is a higher objective than the conviction of any individual. I believe it would be a sad day for our system if that principle were abandoned." On a happier note, it's very satisfactory that the government implemented the Royal Commission's unanimous recommendation that a new system be introduced to deal with claims of miscarriage of justice after all appeals have been exhausted. The old system left this process in the hands of the Home Secretary. The new system, established by the Criminal Appeal Act of 1995, places it with the Criminal Cases Review Commission, an agency independent of government. The CCRC started work in January of 1997. The general view seems to be that it's got off to a good start, though the backlog problem due to the volume of cases is already a serious problem. Needless to say, the setting up of a better system for dealing with alleged miscarriages of justice does not affect the likelihood that a miscarriage of justice will occur. They occur for a great variety of reasons. Sometimes they are the result of wrongful acts by the police, such as the fabrication or planting of evidence, perhaps the result of misplaced zeal to secure a conviction. Or they are the result of a failure by the prosecution to comply with the duty of disclosure of material that might assist the defense. This has now been officially acknowledged as so serious a worry that the new Director of Public Prosecution has asked the CPS Inspectorate to inquire into it, and the Home Office has set up an interdepartmental working party on the problem. And the Attorney General said last night in his speech that he intended to issue new guidelines to prosecutors on the basis of these inquiries. Often, miscarriages of justice are the result of human failings, such as mistaken eyewitness evidence or other errors made by prosecution witnesses, including forensic scientists. Sometimes, they are the result of a false confession by the defendant, leading to a guilty plea, as happened in the case of Judith Ward. Quite often, they are caused by the incompetence or the inefficiency of the defense team in failing to get the defendant's case together or failing to pursue important lines of inquiry. And sometimes no one is really to blame. An innocent defendant has the bad luck to be convicted because of strong but misleading circumstantial evidence. The system has a variety of procedures and rules in place to help reduce the risk that an innocent person will be convicted, though they provide protection equally to the guilty, which is right and proper, since all suspects deserve certain basic rights. But the content of these basic rights has been much debated over recent years. A case in point is the right to silence. The Ransom and Royal Commission on Criminal Justice in 1993, like the Phillips Royal Commission on Criminal Procedure in 1981, recommended by a majority that the traditional rule be preserved so that silence in the police station could not be made the subject of adverse comment by either the prosecution or the defense. But the Conservative government, in the person of Mr. Michael Howard, the Home Secretary, rejected the view of the two Royal Commissions. If a suspect being questioned under caution fails to mention a fact that he later relies on at his trial, which it would have been reasonable to have expected him to have mentioned at that time, the jury can now be invited to consider whether that failure is evidence of guilt. The caution had to be changed to warn the suspect that exercising his right to silence might prejudice his case. The changes were implemented by a Conservative government, but the then Labour opposition, led by Jack Straw as Shadow Home Secretary, did not strenuously object. I sense that they are unlikely to be reversed by this or indeed any future administration. What difference have these changes made? Home Office research has shown that the proportion of suspects giving no comment interviews has fallen from 10% to 6%, a sizable reduction. Not surprisingly, the reduction was greatest amongst those who had had legal advice. But it does not follow that this translates into any more convictions or even more prosecutions. Earlier research on the outcome of over 1,000 interviews had shown that 4/5 of those who were silent in the police station were convicted, often after pleading guilty. In the control group, consisting of suspects who did answer questions, the proportion convicted, curiously, was slightly lower. The researchers, one of whom was a senior police officer, commented, quote, "Abolishing the right to silence might reduce the irritation felt by the police, but would probably do little to increase the number of successful prosecutions." And that was always my own assessment. Some might say that if it makes little difference in practice, why all the fuss about the importance of the right to silence? For me, the fuss was not only about the likely dangers, especially to the innocent, but the point of principle that if the burden of proof lies on the prosecution, it's wrong to penalize the suspect for refusing to assist the police with their inquiries. It's worth noting that a parliamentary committee in the state of Victoria, having come to this country to study Michael Howard's reform, recommended earlier this year that it not be copied there. Perhaps the most useful recently introduced safeguard for the suspect in the police station is tape recording of interviews. The original object was both to discourage improper police questioning and to provide evidence of it when it occurs. The police, understandably, started very hostile, but they quickly came to see its value. Having the suspect's confession on tape increases the proportion of guilty pleas. The tapes also reduce courtroom battles over what the suspect did or did not say. A side benefit has been that the tapes provide valuable raw material for research and for police training. It turns out from such research by Professor John Baldwin of Birmingham University that general ineptitude in questioning is statistically a much greater problem than unacceptable methods of questioning. In a sample of 600 interviews, Baldwin thought that the officer's manner was unduly abrasive or aggressive in only 4%. Access to legal advice for suspects is more problematic. The number who avail themselves of the possibility of free advice in the police station is large. In 1997 to 1998, some 750,000 suspects took advantage of this at a cost to the taxpayer of some £100 million. The problem is, first, the 60% or so of suspects who chose not to ask for it, and the further 5% or so who ask for it, but for one or another reason don't get it. It seems reasonable to assume that at least some of these would have benefited from competent legal advice. But there's also a question about the quality of the help given by those who do get it. Research has shown that this is not by any means always good enough. The Legal Aid Board's latest report stated, quote, "There are significant areas where all types of police station advisers have high levels of non-compliance with the standards of performance laid down by the Law Society." This seems to be as true of solicitor advisers as those who are not, as of those who are not solicitors. The failings of defence lawyers have been documented in a devastating piece of research by Professor Michael McConville and colleagues at Warwick University. The main accusation of their book, Standing Accused, is that defence lawyering is, for the most part, geared towards the routine production of guilty pleas. Quote, "Advisers of all grades fall in with police routines and are responsive to police expectations that the private interview with the client in the police station will be over in a matter of minutes." Quote, "Defence advisers, most of whom are non-qualified staff, are less concerned with establishing the circumstances relating to the alleged offence than with securing from the client a promise to plead guilty. Their dealings with the clients, based in personal relationships, operate on the principle that the client has done something and should plead guilty. Legally aided clients were not generally encouraged to tell their stories. Insofar as the story did emerge, the client was taught that it was not worth recording, that it would not persuade any court, and that it should be abandoned in the face of the police evidence. Client statements were routinely disregarded. Quote, "Conviction is achieved in the office of their own advisor through a process whose methodologies most nearly resemble those of the police themselves. In the magistrate's court, it was rare for the defendant to have a defence based on work done by his lawyers. Any success defence lawyers have at trials themselves," this is a quote, I'm sorry, "any success defence lawyers have at trials themselves tends to be a product of what they can achieve on their feet in court and whatever turns up on the day. In Crown Court cases, there were a few firms that engaged in proactive defence lawyering, preparing the case well in advance, seeking out witnesses, sending inquiry agents to draw up plans of the scene of the crime, employing forensic experts. But such firms were, quote, quite exceptional. And the bar was not any better. A few barristers were strongly committed to cases and were careful to test the underlying basis of a guilty plea, but most barristers were not. Quote, strikingly, on the hearing day at court, but also in conferences in chambers, barristers evince little interest in scrutinizing the evidence or in attempting to convince the defendant of its weight and probative value. Rather, conferences are treated as disclosure interviews, the purpose of which is to extract a guilty plea from the client. It's also a regrettable fact that barristers in criminal cases tend to get their instructions very late. The Crown Court study done for the Runciman Commission in 1993 showed that nearly a third of defence barristers in contested cases only got the brief on the day before the hearing or on the day itself. In a high proportion of cases, the brief had been returned by another barrister. If we were the defendant and knew that ours was such a case, I suspect we wouldn't be very happy. But all efforts to find a workable solution to the problem of the returned brief have so far failed. Of course, most defendants plead guilty, well over 90% in the Magistrates' Court and some 70% in the Crown Court. One hopes that the reason is that most defendants are in fact guilty and cannot see any advantage in putting the prosecution to its proof. No doubt the fact that a defendant who pleads guilty will normally be entitled to a reduction of about one-third of his sentence is a contributory factor. The Runciman Commission acknowledged that the sentence discount may sometimes lead an innocent defendant to plead guilty. But I do not think that the Royal Commission received one single submission suggesting that the sentence discount should be abolished. It serves the interests of the prosecution in helping to secure a conviction, of the defendant in getting him a lower sentence, and of the taxpayer in saving the expense of a trial. Whether the victim of the crime is always content about the reduced sentence must be doubtful, but at least the victim is spared the ordeal of having to give evidence. If the tendency of defense lawyers is too easily to accept the police version of the case, this tendency is likely to be aggravated by the present strong emphasis on trying to get defendants to plead guilty at the earliest possible moment, and the fast-track processing of cases with the nationwide introduction of what are known as the NERI reforms. Pilot studies of early first hearings for straightforward guilty pleas and early administrative hearings for other cases showed that significant gains in terms of earlier pleas and rapid disposal were being achieved. But the danger is that defendants will be rushed into premature decisions as to how to plead, that the case will be dealt with before the defense are ready, and that courts will send defendants to prison without waiting for reports. The danger of rushing applies to the prosecution as well. The government is currently preparing to launch a new major inquiry into the business of the criminal courts on the model of Lord Wolfe's inquiry into civil justice. In September, the Court Service published a 75-page consultation paper entitled Transforming the Crown Court. Commending the report, Lord Irvine, the Lord Chancellor, said this: "I intend that today's perception of a fragmented and incoherent system with frustration, wasted time, and cancelled hearings will soon be as out of date as the quill pen." The ideas canvassed in the consultation paper included more rigorous case preparation, active case management according to streaming of cases, time limits enforced by sanctions, including on-the-spot fines for lawyers, appropriate IT support, and changes in court listing to ensure that the case goes forward on the date scheduled. The inquiry will apparently include magistrates' courts as well as crown courts. I referred to my criticisms of the Wolfe reforms in my last lecture. I would be very concerned if innovations in civil justice based on the concept of judicial case management were to be applied to criminal cases before they've been properly tested. It's obviously vital that the inquiry should have proper research capacity and that any resulting proposals are piloted before being implemented nationally, none of which happened with the Wolfe reforms. Another impending controversial development is the introduction of state-salaried defense lawyers as part of the new Criminal Defense Service under the Access to Justice Act 1999. I agree with those who believe that this could result in lower quality defense work, though, as has been said, the present average level is unfortunately already not as high as it should be. But everything will depend on the way in which the new public defender service is set up, including, of course, the level of its funding, and even more, its staffing and leadership, and whether it can build up a reputation for independence and good quality work. There are examples of high quality public defender services in other jurisdictions. One such is the Neighborhood Defense Service in Harlem, in New York, run since 1990 by the Vera Institute of Justice. It can be done, it should be done. As to whether it will be done, time alone will tell. I have to say that I incline to the pessimistic rather than to the optimistic view. If the Crown Prosecution Service is any indication of the likely quality of work by state-salaried defense lawyers, the omens are worrying. The recent Glidewell report on the CPS gave a gloomy assessment. Quote, "The CPS is not seen generally as providing an attractive career opportunity, nor overall do CPS lawyers seem to be held in as high professional regard as they and we would wish." And, quote, "Overall, The CPS has not succeeded in attracting enough lawyers with the skills and weight of experience which it needs, both to do its job properly and to establish a reputation for excellence. It would be most unfortunate if the new Criminal Defence Service were to acquire a similar reputation. There has, of course, been a much longer running battle over whether the CPS should be permitted to conduct cases in the Crown Court. On this, I support the view advanced by the Bar and by senior judges, rather than that espoused by the Solicitors Branch. My reason for opposing extended rights of audience for the CPS is not primarily worry about the quality of CPS advocacy, although that is a source of concern. My opposition is mainly based on the fact that CPS lawyers are employees of an organisation which unavoidably has a bureaucratic agenda. The Lord Chancellor tried to meet this point by Section 42 of the 1999 Act, which provides that the duty to the court takes precedence over any other duty. But that does not deal with the point, since regardless of his seniority and experience, no employee in an organisation like the CPS can escape the pressures to conform with what I've called the bureaucratic agenda. At present, if the CPS and the barrister for the prosecution disagree about the handling of the case, the independent barrister's voice is there to challenge the CPS approach. When the CPS starts to use its own new right to conduct contested cases on its own, that will no longer be so, to the potential detriment, I believe, of the quality of justice. Quality is one of the themes constantly mentioned by both ministers and the Legal Aid Board in referring to the plans for legal services under the 1999 Access to Justice Act. A crucial selling point of the new system for public funding of legal services, it is claimed, is that only firms that can satisfy the required quality of work standards to obtain contracts from the Legal Services Commission will be permitted to do the work. The auditing of standards through franchising by the Legal Aid Board may have had some effect in raising standards of work, at least of some firms. But the danger, as a new study puts it, is that the audit, rather than the legal aid client, assumes central importance, and that, quote, managerialist concerns colonize legal practice. The board becomes the real client, and the main focus is keeping one's franchise. The challenge for the new Legal Services Commission, shortly to replace the Legal Aid Board, is finding a way to balance the need, on the one hand, for fundholders to be efficient and accountable, and on the other hand, to promote an environment that permits them also to provide genuine, as opposed to merely paper, quality of service. There are so many important current developments affecting criminal justice that it's difficult to keep abreast of them, and even more difficult sometimes to be sure whether they are to be welcomed or deplored. It's clear that some of the reforms are driven primarily by the Treasury's voracious appetite for cost-cutting. Where money is to be saved, justice is liable to be at risk. But the fact that money is to be saved, or that other efficiency gains are in prospect, does not in itself prove that the proposed reform should be opposed by right-thinking citizens. The best interests of defendants, of lay witnesses, of victims of crime, of jurors, may also be served by improvements in the operation of the system. Certainly no one who's worked in the criminal justice system could deny that there is room for improvement in that regard. But after due allowance has been made for the objective that the system should run efficiently and economically, an even greater concern is that it should be so organized as to reflect the right balance between the proper interests of the prosecution and the proper interests of the defense. Experience suggests that striving to achieve that right balance is a task that will always defeat us. Whatever balance is achieved, there will always be someone calling for it to be changed. So the work of adjusting the balance is never done. Thank you.
Well, Michael, thank you very much. It's the custom of the Hamlin lecturers that the lecturer takes questions afterwards, and Professor Zander is eager to do so.
There is a roving mic somewhere, both up and down. Two roving mics.
How do you think the NERI reforms are likely to survive when the Human Rights Act comes in, as far as right to a fair trial and giving defence ample opportunity to prepare their case? Will they survive?
I'm not going to speculate on that. They will be challenged, I'm sure, and we will see.
Thank you. I've been both a witness at a magistrate's court, county court, and also in the jury in a crown court. And I'd just like to say briefly that the various jurors I served with were sensible people, and the judges were very nice, but a lot of time appeared to be wasted, to my mind, by futile questionings by the defense and the prosecutor. But what I want to ask is, what is your view of solicitors appearing in courts? Because if the solicitor has originally taken the case and done all the inquiry, searching for evidence and so on, and assuming he's reasonably articulate and a bit of an actor, why could not the solicitor or someone in his office who has got all the evidence appear in court?
I agree, he can. Do, and they can now, solicitors now have the right to appear or to qualify themselves to appear in not only the Magistrates' Court, which has been the case for a long time, and the County Court, but also now in the High Court on the civil side and the Crown Court on the criminal side. So your point has been accepted by the government. Not many solicitors, in fact, do it, but there are many reasons for that, and that would take us a long time to analyse the reasons for that, but they now are able to do it if they wish.
Oh yes, hello, Mr. Zander. I'd like to ask you whether you think that the police have a slightly overzealous attitude towards questioning suspects on the basis of the presumption of guilt.
Well, that's a very interesting question. I would say that a police officer who doesn't start with a presumption of guilt is a very odd police officer, because he's arrested someone on the basis of reasonable suspicion that this person has committed the offence for which he's now being questioned. So it seems to me logical that he would have to start with that assumption that I've got the right person in front of me, although I reserve my position in that regard. I may not have the right person in front of me. That's now for examination. But he must start off with that hypothesis. Otherwise, it seems to me, he hasn't got the reasonable grounds to suspect that is required by the law for him to have the suspect there in the first place. Is he then overzealous in the way in which he questions suspects? Well, yes, the answer is sometimes yes. But I think John Baldwin's research is interesting here, and I've already referred to it, that his worry is not so much over aggressiveness, but rather ineptitude and incompetence in questioning, lack of preparation of the officer who's undertaking the questioning. And I think that may be more of a problem than what you're calling overzealousness. But I think there is another major problem which the police are now increasingly aware of, the problem of how to listen so that you actually hear what's being said to you. It's a failing which is said to afflict the male species more than the female species, I don't know. But it certainly afflicts police officers, because they start with this hypothesis. And then the evidence is they don't actually listen to the suspect very well, and they don't pay much attention to what he's saying, brush him aside. And the new form of police training, which I actually took part in, it's a five-day course, and I actually went on the five-day course to see what it was like. And the essence of it seemed to be, listen to the suspect very carefully, and then listen to him some more, and then listen even more, and then start asking him a lot of questions. That seemed to me a good idea.
What I just wanted to point out was that I wanted to ask you, since your statistics had revealed that there was a drop in the plea from the defendant for the right to silence, which seemed to indicate that if you actually said something and rejected that right to silence, you were less likely to be convicted.
No,
was that not
I didn't
what you said?
No, I didn't say that. But you must have misheard me. What has come down is the number of no comment interviews, but it doesn't relate at all to either cases brought or convictions. There isn't any evidence that it's had any effect on either one or the other. Gentleman right at the back there.
Why do you think that the right of appeal against decision to summary trial is unlikely to be exercised frequently?
Because rights of appeal are very rarely exercised. It's very strange, but people seem to accept their fate. Take the number of cases who appeal against their conviction in the Magistrates Court. Virtually nobody appeals. You have a complete right of appeal going to the Crown Court to start all over again and have the case reheard. But of those vast numbers of people who go, of course most of them plead guilty, but of the large number who plead not guilty, I mean in terms of numbers, it's a lot of people, hardly any of them appeal.
Is it very expensive?
No, not particularly. I mean, it's, of course, expense comes into it, certainly, but that's not the main reason. I think the main reason that people don't appeal is because they don't appeal, they just don't feel like it. And I think that will apply equally in this category. Now, I'm sure that some people will appeal, of course. It'll be very interesting to see how that works out, because the Home Office calculation must be, I would have thought, in terms of money. Well, the figure they put out is £105 million saving from this new reform. That presumably is a net figure after allowing for the cost of appeals, but nobody has any idea what proportion of cases will in fact be appealed. It's just pure guesswork. Yes, up in the gallery, excellent. The gallery should not be neglected.
I want to ask about the Criminal Cases Review Commission. In its early days, it's covered a number of the very prominent cases where the spade work had been done by others, often over a period of years. Now that they've got those sort of prominent cases out of the way, do you think that the Commission has the resources to do that kind of digging, which may not have been done by the lawyers in the first place and may fall to the Commission to have to do if they really are to uncover major miscarriages of justice?
Well, I hope the answer to that is yes. Of course, one doesn't really know. Sitting here at the university, as it were, one can't tell the answer to that question, and certainly it's much too early to have any real sense of it. I'm pretty sure, I've always been convinced, that the Commission would still have to rely on the industrious journalist and the television program, which traditionally has been the way, the vehicle, to get a case to public attention and then create concern, which then leads other people to, as you say, work on the basis of that digging that's already been done. And I think that will always be true. You can't expect any public body to engage in the intense, detailed, minute examination of really large numbers of cases, not practical. Also, of course, they do still have many high-profile cases. I was just speaking to them yesterday in Birmingham, and they said that they just had the case of Ruth Ellis referred to them, for example. So they do have many high-profile, sensational cases, as well as the ordinary cases that one hasn't yet heard of. But they are absolutely plagued by the backlog problem. They have 3 or 4 cases coming in every day on an average. 3 to 4 cases every day, and there's no way that they're going to get abreast of that backlog. Well, it'll take them years to get abreast of it. They told me they are now dealing with more cases than are coming in, but only just. So with a backlog of about 2,000 cases, it's a very bleak outlook in terms of the time that it's going to take them. And also, then, of course, the resources that they can apply to any particular case. There's got to be a trade-off between they can't take 10 years on a case, so they'll say, well, okay, if we're going to deal with a case within a year or two, there are limited resources we can put into it. And the Home Office has not been terrible, but it's not been wonderful, and understandably, I mean, so that's the name of the game, life, as it were. You can't get unlimited resources. The chairman of the CCRC has asked for more resources, and the Home Secretary said, yes, here's a little bit more, but not as much as you want. That will continue, undoubtedly. Gentleman behind you, yes.
Just 3 things, very briefly. First, you talk about return of cases. Somebody in my chambers had a case listed for all next week. Yesterday was a telephone call. The case is starting 10:30 tomorrow. The judge has run out of work. Mm. He said, I can't do it. Court, too bad. Get somebody else. Never seen the defendant or anything.
Yeah.
Two, plea bargaining. I think there is. And I was in a case where five defendants, evidence that my client stabbed somebody. The other four, the evidence was that they sort of joined in. The prosecution offered that if I pleaded guilty of stabbing and I was going to go down for it, they'd accept a plea to a fray for the other four. And the judge, now Mr. Justice Douglas Brown, had only given us an indication that an affray would not carry a prison sentence. Mm. My client refused. At the end of a prosecution case, the evidence was that these four, rather than trying to start an affray, were trying to disarm me and take my knife off me. Yeah, they'd have pleaded guilty of affray to stop them going to prison. That is what's wrong with plea bargaining. Mm. Finally, and this is a question, I was interested in what you said about Scotland. Perhaps you could comment on the following comments made by a Scottish sheriff when addressing the Medical Legal Society a few years ago. He said the trial by sheriff alone, I think it's a sheriff's summary court, was acceptable to Scotland because of these differences. Firstly, their powers of sentence were limited. He could not send them for sentence elsewhere. Mm. Secondly, they were tried by the sheriff, a professional lawyer, whose status is far greater than stipendary magistrates. They are addressed as my lord and may have jurisdiction. You know, they can be trying in their civil jurisdiction, they probably have a jurisdiction somewhere between a high court judge and a circuit judge in England. And he said it was for two reasons. That the sheriff was, if you like, a high judicial appointment which held respect, not, and I don't want to wish to be disrespectful by stipendaries, but he would not have, I think he'd have been insulted to be considered a stipendary. And secondly, no power to give greater sentences.
Yeah. Well, I mean, those are all very important points. On the first one of the returned brief, my own conclusion, obviously I need to be extremely brief in replying, is that there's nothing that can be done about it. There's nothing effective that you can do about the problem of the return brief. I used to think that there was. I've now concluded reluctantly there is nothing that can be done about it that makes any sense. And so one has to live with that, because for obvious reasons that the case otherwise, the last minute adjournment and the case that goes on longer than expected will have that effect. And one has to work within that system. Guilty pleas, well, there are risks in guilty pleas, but so far no one, as far as I can see, is proposing that we abolish the guilty plea or even the sentence discount. So there again one says it has very bad side effects sometimes. One hopes not too often. And on the third point of your sheriff analysis, I accept all those points. I mean, they are clearly valid points. Whether the stipendiary is to be preferred to the three lay magistrate, I mean, taking away from Scotland, in Scotland they're lucky to have that situation. We don't have that situation and we can't get it, I don't think. So at least it'd be difficult to get it. We're not going to move so that the stipendiary magistrate has about him the same aura as the sheriff does in Scotland, which is a pity. But there it is.
Do you think that the Court of Appeal is the best venue to assess the precise impact of fresh evidence on the safety of a conviction, the Stafford and Lavoisier?
Well, is the Court of Appeal the best? As far as I can see, it's the only one. Whether it's the best, I don't know. Is there another? How else could it be done? Oh, retrials. I'm so sorry. Yes, I take your point. I thought you meant at some other tribunal. I'm in favour of retrials if the court and the Royal Commission express itself as strongly in favour of retrials rather than quashing a conviction and sending the appellant back to prison where there is any doubt about the matter. I do not favour a retrial if there's no doubt about the matter. It seems absurd for the Court of Appeal to quash a conviction, order a retrial, when it has absolutely no doubt whatever that this person has been properly convicted and that the fresh evidence doesn't amount to a row of beans. So it's got to look at the fresh evidence for the purpose of reaching that view. And therefore, and this is the awkward bit, it's going to have to exercise a power which is not quite the power of the jury, but it's some kind of a screening power. Somebody's got to do that. Otherwise, there'll be endless retrials. It would be an easy solution for the defendant in prison just to say, well, thank you very much, I'll have another go with another jury, and all I need to do is come along and say, I've got some fresh evidence. Court of Appeal can't look at it. Why? Because constitutionally they're not supposed to look at fresh evidence. That's not acceptable. Can't be acceptable. So you've got to give the Court of Appeal a screening power. Once they have a screening power, they've got to look at the evidence and do what is a kind of a jury role, to say, well, yes, there's a doubt, let's have a retrial. No, there's no doubt, send him back to prison. I can't see any way around that. I'm sorry, I've looked at it and looked at it and looked at it, but I don't see a way around that.
I think we've got time for one more.
What is your view, Professor Zander, regarding the proposed extension of the prosecution's right of appeal?
The one that we read about this morning?
Quite.
Well, I haven't had time to collect a view. I've been rather busy since this morning, so I barely got hold of the idea. I asked the Attorney General's office to fax over the relevant bit of his speech last night, which was the Tom Sargent Memorial Lecture.
Yeah, that's where I heard it.
And which they kindly did, and so I've got it in my knapsack. So I've read it, mm-hmm. But all it really says is let the Law Commission look at it. We, that's to say, the Lord Chancellor, the Home Secretary, and the Attorney General have referred the matter to the Law Commission for advice. But it's on the basis of, wouldn't it be a good idea? We rather think it might be a good idea for the prosecution to have this right of appeal against a judge's adverse ruling. And that sounds, I would think, that will sound horrendous to most English lawyers. They'll say, what? You must be joking. But when you start to think about it, as I began to try to start to think about it, I mean, one can't always get one's thoughts in order right away. I began to see the force of the question. I'm willing to look at the question. I'm not certainly willing to say, no, it shouldn't happen. Definitely shouldn't happen. But I'm very, I would be very cautious about accepting it. And I was glad to see that the Attorney General said maybe if it happens at all, it should happen only with the Attorney General's consent. Mm-hmm. A bit like appeals against unduly lenient sentence. I mean, many people thought that was basically a right of appeal for the Sun newspaper. You know, if the Sun newspaper gets very agitated about an unduly lenient sentence, that it should go up to the Court of Appeal and they should have another look. Mm-hmm. But it hasn't turned out that way. In fact, the Attorney General's exercised his discretion to send up cases very carefully. Most of them have been accepted by the Court of Appeal, and sentences have been increased. Some of them haven't. So that seems to be working reasonably well, although at first sight, one wouldn't have been very keen on that. I wasn't very keen on it. So I think my answer is, let's have a look at it. Let's wait for the Law Commission to do whatever work they're going to do, and let's look at it.
Well, Michael Zander, our warmest thanks. Once again, you've shown us a formidable grasp of yet another subject and provided us with a feast of things to think about in the week before your final lecture. That lecture is going to be on human rights. It will be here next Tuesday at the same time. Thank you very much. Thank you.